so we wanted to do our presentations back to back and then have a discussion. So you've heard about non-point sources and MS4 permits for that, and you've heard about sort of the national level and OA criteria and the CBD lawsuit. We're going to focus on point sources. First off, for those of you I haven't met, I'm the Casco Bay people with Friends of Casco Bay, and our work is specifically focused on Casco Bay, and we have about 25 years of data relating to the Bay. So it first started as a volunteer organization with Joe Payne as the original Bay keeper, and today we have staff of 10 and 2 boats on the Bay. So we have 2 research scientists, and I try to go out with them as much as possible. And we have a pump-out boat that over the summer pumps out waste on boats so that it doesn't get discharged into the Bay. So we're on the water year-round, and we collect data year-round. These are the parameters that we test for, and with respect to OA, a lot of these categories is useful. The investigating anomalies includes things like looking at the cause of fish kills or algal blooms. Our staff does most of the monitoring using DataSons. We have 3 profile sites. We used to have 10, now we have 3. One in Broad Sound, one off of Falmouth and Cumberland Foreside, and one by the mouth of the Presumpscot River. So we can get sort of a good read on conditions in the Bay, and we go to those sites once a month. And this year we have our first unattended sond. It's by the ferry dock on Cousins Island, and it's the first time we're getting data around the clock, and it's working out really well. We're really excited about it. We augment what we do with citizen scientists. They sample at 37 sites around the Bay every other Saturday from April to October, twice a day, and that's the data that we use to create the sort of health index of Casco Bay. And we also started doing events like a Nabbing Nitrogen event this summer. We coordinated this in particular. There were local municipalities involved, but we worked closely with Maine Department of Environmental Protection. And the goal of it was to get a snapshot in time of nitrogen loading, because it was just one grab sample. 97 people all take the sample at 10:10 a.m. And what was so cool about this sample was, after 2 weeks of no rain, it rained and there was a CSO event right before we did this sample, so we can't wait to get these results. Not that it will be indicative of, it will give us a snapshot of what nutrient loading can look like from one stormwater event. So I'm going through this overview because this is some of the science that is 25 years of data collection that can be applied to policy decisions. And this is just our science, and it combined with the science of lots of other people can be used to help find policy solutions. And as a waterkeeper organization, we use science and the law to advocate for our MLB Casco Bay. So I don't have to talk about this. Others who are much more knowledgeable have already covered coastal acidification. For some reason, the slide, I don't know why the graphic isn't up here, but what this slide would show, if the graphic were here, is that our data shows that when there's more fresh water, there is more nitrogen. So, and the sources of excess nitrogen in the Bay, this is an old graphic, but the ratios are pretty accurate, and we've talked about non-point source, we've talked about atmospheric. I'm focusing on this aspect in my presentation. So Clean Water Act, the version that we all know as the Clean Water Act, was passed in 1972, and you can't discharge pollutants into waters of the United States from a point source without a permit. And those permits are known as National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System permits, or NPDES permits. So it can be point sources are conveyances like pipes. That's a CSO. Whoops, sorry. That's a CSO right there, which is a combined sewer overflow, or from a discharge pipe from a treatment plant, power plants, things like that. So in 2001, EPA, which issues NPDES permits, delegated the authority to issue those permits in Maine to the Maine Department of Environmental Protection. So since that time, the permits here are known as NPDES permits. And EPA continues to oversee that permit program and to maintain enforcement authority. And this is just an example of what a front page of one of those permits looks like. There's a permit, for those of you who haven't seen it, and then a fact sheet attached to the permit that has all the analysis. And that's what's always so interesting to talk to scientists about, because that's where all the explanation is of how the department did its calculations to arrive at what it put in permit. So, in its simplest sense, through a NPDES permit, we can impose monitoring requirements if we need more information. We can set limits to the amount of nitrogen that can be discharged. And I think also is equally important, NPDES permits, the term of the permits is 5 years. So there's an iterative process or a chance to constantly be looking at the impacts of the terms of that permit. And the basis for NPDES or NPDES permits is to maintain water quality, and if it's degraded, to bring it back up to water quality. So you don't wait until the water body is impaired before imposing stricter limitations if that's what's needed. So it's a process that, even though this tool's been around for a long time, has a lot of implications for us in how we use it. So then the question becomes, how do we determine in an individual permit if we need to set nitrogen limits? And Aaron set us up nicely with the discussion that we either have numeric criteria or narrative criteria. So either a number, and if you discharge above that number, you're going to have to reduce it, or we look at the impacts on the biological setting. So in Maine, there was a resolve in 2007. Yes, this is the pet actually trained to clean up after himself. There was a resolve in 2007 to ask the state to develop a plan for adopting numeric criteria. This is the preamble from that recognizes that nutrient pollution contributes to nuisance algal growth, that it comes from diverse sources. I've only highlighted two of those there because I'm only focusing on point sources, not to single them out in any other way. And it's also noted that bays south of us already are suffering significant water quality degradation. Our goal is we don't want to go there. So this resolve was passed and asks the state to do something with numeric criteria. So these were the four items that DEP was charged with developing: conceptual plan, a work plan, a report on technological approaches, and an inventory of significant point and non-point sources of nutrients to the waters of Casco Bay. Casco Bay was singled out because it was identified in the legislation as a priority. It's in the most populous watershed. It faces threats from future development, is already known to have high concentrations of nutrients, and because of data collection from organizations like ours, including ours, there was already a fairly good set of available nutrient data. So consistent with that resolve, DEP completed a report to the legislature in 2008, and since then there has not been any further development of numeric criteria. Now, that's pretty true around the country, that there hasn't been development of numeric criteria. This is an interactive map from the EPA website. If you actually were to go to this, you could click on those. There, level 5 would be a state that has a complete set of nitrogen and phosphorus criteria. There are none. And there are only a few states that have level 4, which is two or more water types with nitrogen or phosphorus criteria. So the fact that we don't have them is consistent with what's happening around the country. It's something that, you know, we should talk about whether or not it makes sense for us to have numeric criteria. Narrative criteria, the way that's what we're currently using in our NPDES permits to determine whether there should be nitrogen limits set. And the test is the reasonable potential for the discharge of total nitrogen to cause or contribute to non-attainment of applicable water quality standards in marine waters. And the way that that's being applied is twofold. The Department of Environmental Protection is either looking at 0.32 milligrams per liter of nitrogen, and if it's above that, is there indication that the nitrogen is having a negative impact on eelgrass? And if it's an area, if the discharge is in an area that either doesn't have eelgrass or hasn't historically had beds of eelgrass, then they're looking at 0.45 milligrams per liter of total nitrogen and using dissolved oxygen as the indicator. I'm going through this quickly. There are people here from DEP. There are detailed questions about this. When we have the question and answer, I certainly will refer to them. This just gives you, this is from an overview of our data. It just gives you an idea of the levels of nitrogen that we're seeing in Casco Bay. The data is broken down into three subsets. That was done just where there was a natural break in the data. The fact that the green dot is 0.38 below isn't an indication by us that that's fine or okay or anything like that. It's just how the data is reported. Nicole looked earlier at the fact that the eelgrass cover has changed a lot in Casco Bay. Just the fact that it's missing, though, it doesn't answer the question that the nitrogen was the cause of that, because we know that a lot of eelgrass loss was due to predation. So just because it was there and isn't there still doesn't answer whether there needs to be nitrogen limits in the permit. This is just an example from a report on the type of things that are looked for. They're looking for density in the eelgrass beds. Is the edges of the eelgrass meadow retreating? And then, especially in the late summer, are there signs of prevalence of epiphytes and nuisance algae? And those can be indicators that the eelgrass is suffering from too much nitrogen. And then, how far do you look? Like, how far are you looking at eelgrass beds to see if there is an issue? And this is also a fairly new area, and one that Angie talked about back in the June symposium. So for traditional looking at, you know, pollutants, traditionally the DEP has used the Cormex model, which has these ranges of dilution. And for nitrogen, right now, DEP is looking at far field dilution, and you can see that that is a much broader field. These are just from two permits that I just took out as an example, just so you can see the difference. The calculation of far field dilution is going to be different for each 50s permit. And far field dilution, it's a new model. DEP is working on it. It's not a model that we see used elsewhere in the country for looking at nitrogen, and it doesn't analyze the reasonable potential in the near field. It's looking at a much broader scope than that. So both EPA and Casco Bay have questioned the use of the far field dilution model, and it's something that the department has consulted with an outside expert, and something that would be wonderful to have a discussion about if that's appropriate. So, the questions for this group, and these come out of Aaron's talk and my talk, and maybe these aren't even the right questions, you can certainly change them or let us know, but this should be, as the 2007 resolve asks, be developing numeric nutrient criteria. I don't know if the answer to that is whether one is better than the other, but it's a question we could ask. And consistent with the 2007 resolve, should we continue to treat Casco Bay as a priority? And if we're going to look at setting up a model for one area, should we continue to focus on that area? How should the reasonable potential of nitrogen in the effluent be evaluated? Is it the far field dilution model, or is it a different model? Do we need a model? And then sort of tying back into Aaron's presentation, should we be developing nutrient or other criteria specific to ocean or coastal acidification? So I want to open this up for discussion at this point and questions, and there are so many experts in the room that I hope that we just have a good dialogue about what we do with these or whether we should form a small subgroup to be working on some or all of these questions.
I have one really general question. It goes back historical. When did coastal acidification begin? When did it begin having an impact? Can we say, have we looked at sediment and said, oh, well, the 1970 over the power?
Do you want to take that?
Maybe Joe or Larry may have a better idea, but for instance, I would say that before the Clean Water Act in 1971, there's probably a whole lot more organic matter in Maine waters than there is today. So from the perspective of respiring organic matter, my guess is it was potentially worse before the Clean Water Act. But I think Aaron put it best. I don't think we have enough data to say this is what happened, and then this was the biological effect.
So eograsses and other such things were an indicator?
So the loss of eelgrass, if it's due to light attenuation, that can sometimes be linked to nutrients, right? So you get nutrients, it grows phytoplankton, and it shades out eelgrass. A lot of the eelgrass in our case, of course, could also be green crabs, for instance. So again, it's a little hard to parse out which is the most direct factor.
I'll add to that at the global scale, right? If we think about CO2 as a driver of ocean acidification globally, we know that in each area there's a lot of variability of pH. But by using proxies for what pH, the pH environment was 100 years ago, 150 years ago, we can actually show that the average pH level was down here, was, let's say, here, and now it's down here. Even though there's a lot of variability now, there's a lot of variability then, on hundreds of years time scale, we can certainly see the overall effects of anthropogenic CO2 emissions. The challenge is at some of these more local scales and local time scales and local spatial scales, understanding that baseline is not as easy.
It's also a hard question. You said you were going to start with a simple question, but it's not a simple question because it's hard. Like, it's not as if all this data has been collected and suddenly it's like, okay, now we're measuring it. It's something that's been progressing over time since the start of the Industrial Revolution, and the way that we monitor and measure and think about this has been evolving as well. So I don't know that that there's a specific... I can't answer your question.
Go ahead.
For you, what was it? Yeah, go ahead.
I think that ocean acidification became known because of the oyster industry, first on the West Coast, and then, a little bit on the East Coast. And it was there was a tipping point reached at a hatchery level, which is very different from, out of the natural estuary, but it was in the mid part of the last decade. And so probably in the 2005 to 2007 timeframe, the Pacific Coast of mostly Washington State and Oregon experienced an 80% drop in their hatchery larval production. It was definitely huge.
That's a fundamentally different physical...
True, but then for us, which is more of the kind of drivers we saw a huge impact on our business that kind of came to a peak in 2009.
Yeah, it's a physical thing because you're seeing it as a result of storms.
Right. That was in the wettest year.
It was one of the wettest years.
But
I guess here's the point I would make is that once we understood what was happening and we started buffering the water every time we brought water into raised larvae, our production became perfect. I mean, it's not as though it got better, we could live with it. It became perfect. So it, obviously the impact was quite a bit before that, but it came to a critical point at that 2009 for us. And it's probably very different in every location. Some places I don't think it hit that tipping point.
So coastal acidification was occurring in the 80s and the 90s?
Well, it's been created for
Yes.
Do we have a handle based on the volume of manufacture of fertilizers and their use in Maine? How much is sold in Maine? How much of that opportunity for increased nutrient loading is there? I mean, obviously, we have a handle on what the atmosphere of CO2 is estimated.
So you're asking if we know what the nutrient loading is for fertilizers?
As part of trying to answer in what time frame has things changed to a degree that would be one of the influencing factors that we ought to be able to measure by looking at what the sale of nitrogen based fertilizers do.
Yeah, I think in terms of answering the question of what that tipping point before answering your question, what are we looking at? Are we looking at coral reefs? Are we looking at the oyster industry? You know, and it's cumulative. Okay, so in Casco Bay, has Mike left already? Yeah, I mean, we have data that looks at the change in pH and the change in temperature over time, but in terms of answering that specific question, I don't know that we can answer it with precision. In terms of the impact of fertilizers and pulling that out of what percentage is that of stormwater pollution? No, that's something that I think there's the Casco Bay Estuary Partnership is creating a nutrient council, and I think one of the questions that has been discussed is because there isn't a total maximum daily load that pulls out what everything is, but should we have that better type of understanding and then be targeting those type of resources. And I know that what we've done in the meantime is have a basecaping program that encourages people to, you know, not use fertilizers, and we work with towns on fertilizer and pesticide bans. But I maybe from the county, do you have...
Yeah, we have some data. At Pomona County's Water Conservation District, we have a landscaping program, and that's the objective of that, too, is to, again, assess whether you need to apply some kind of enhancement, and then if you do, exactly what and what concentration. So we have some data on sales, and I think New England Interstate Water Pollution Control Commission also has some, because they've done work on this in Massachusetts, but they're gathering it New England-wide. Does it give a whole picture? No, but it helps fill in part of, if we look at it from a scientific standpoint, a mass balance. You know, here's our water body, here are the sources coming in, and here's how those sources are used to help answer part of that question.
Yeah. Nicole?
But to call back to these big take-home slide message earlier, it's not just how much nutrients are there, but how much of it is moving and flowing, and that is a combination of the concentration of nutrients plus the storm frequency and intensity. So it could be that nutrient loadings per se has not changed at all over the time, but it's the storm frequency and intensity that could have.
The delivery.